path of intention. And I thought before I continue a little bit with my thoughts tonight, I wanted to see if you had any responses or reactions to last week's talk, or if you, during this intervening week, whether any of you paid any attention to intentions, and whether it made any difference for you during the week. In other words, did the talk have any effect?
I was going to say, I noticed that and this wasn't not a very, this wasn't something I was thinking I would say, but my motives and intentions were very ego-driven. How did I look? How did people see me? How would this make me position myself? Uh-huh.
So you found that your intentions were very ego-driven.
Mm-hmm.
If most people, if they're honest, would say the same thing, I think. Thank you. And in seeing that, did that change a little bit the choices you made?
A little bit. I think it was more of the noticing. Mm-hmm. That was the only stage I got to.
It's pretty good. Thank you.
I found that the question, the point that you brought up of there being varying grades of subtlety of intention is very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Although it was easy to say that I intended to go get groceries,
uh-huh,
to think about the fact that I was trying to keep from being hungry,
mm-hmm,
was on a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be able to think that if the bottom level was the intent to have food, then just being able to do that with that in mind,
mm-hmm,
to start from that basic ground, made a difference in how the next step, the next grocer step,
uh-huh,
was
at the grocery.
Was parsed, yes. And
beautiful. And it was interesting. You can kind of find a very basic intention, you know, to get food and feed yourself, and the intention carries you to the grocery and carries you down the aisles, and then you see the aisle for chocolate or ice cream, and then it's interesting to see how the intention might change. Someone else. So, yes.
I try on a very basic level. As soon as I left, I decided that my intention. Usually, I drive very fast. I get on the freeway soon, and I made it my intention to drive skillfully and safely. And that's the way I drove.
Mm.
I had immediate gratification for flying there. And then I did in some other ways throughout the week too. But that was the most immediately satisfying.
So it was actually satisfying to change the way you drove.
It was satisfying also to express that intention to myself and to make me aware that's really what I wanted.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you.
This wasn't something that you specifically brought up last week. However, you've mentioned it a number of times before about mindfulness or awareness of spending of money. In particular, that moment of exchange, of handing money over to another person. And what particularly is, what is going on in your mind or my mind at that particular point in time. And I've taken that practice much to heart many times. And when I make really concerted efforts to have that level of awareness, I find it incredible how often I'm aware of having exchanged money about 15 minutes afterwards, and not right at the moment, not what was really going on right then, and it's a really great trigger for how much I'm caught up in that whole process of exchange, without and losing awareness of the subtleties of the moment, of my feelings, of my interaction with the other person, of my intentions for buying that product, mm-hmm, or spending the money, all of those different levels and gradations that go around that whole process.
I think sometimes when we're in a hurry to get what we need and get out of there onto the next thing, we miss a lot of opportunities. When I, last cashier I was at, which is a couple hours ago, I went to Fry's Electronics. So we had our little exchange of money, or, you know, and I could have easily just kind of spun around and just left right that moment, at the moment. But rather, I paused for maybe it was a second. It probably wasn't very long. I just paused and just kind of stood there and turned my gaze up at that person. And we looked at each other, and there was nothing we had to do. We just kind of looked at each other. And that person also took the time. And there was a moment of recognition of these two human beings were kind of acknowledging each other. Our transaction had been all over, and we just, you know, just no more business. It's just like two human beings, and it felt very satisfying to have that moment. Just and it's, you know, it's easy for me to remember all the times where I just kind of spun around, and, you know, it's done with. So there was an opportunity there that was very precious, and I left the store feeling kind of a little bit better than, you know, than I would otherwise. Yes.
Well, I wasn't here last week, so I didn't think about it. But your discussion about exchanging money makes me think, because I'm a shopkeeper, and I think it will be interesting to look at it from my perspective, because I'm receiving money a lot, not as much as I'd like.
And what is your perspective of receiving, being in the receiving end?
There's certainly a fair amount of desire there. There's also a lot of human interaction that goes on, because it's a small business. But I think there's a lot of not paying attention, because perhaps of the desire. So it would be interesting. I'm not quite sure what goes on.
Last week I gave I don't know if it was a good example, but I gave an example, I made up an example of two people who started a company together. And so they both contributed the same amount of money and the same amount of time and everything for a few years until the company went under. But each of them, when they started the company, the two people had very different intentions. And the first person's intention was to make as much money as possible, to be a millionaire before he or she was 30, you know, which is the thing around here, right? And then the other person's intention was to try to create as a compassionate environment for the employees as possible, a place where the employees can be the best and employees can come out, with a feeling of cooperation, of care, of concern for each other, and their best qualities and best efficiencies can come out in a wonderful way. And I've known people who started companies specifically with that intention. So I know it's possible. And the idea was that after a couple of years, these two people are working side by side with very different intentions, and their company goes bankrupt. The inner life of those two people will be quite different, I suspect. The inner life of accumulation of 2 years of desire, of greed, will take its toll, will affect that kind of inner character of that person. And when the company fails and they lose all their money, that person's, you know, basic, you know, 2 years of expectation and goal-driven activity is just deflated. Whereas the second person, maybe the fact that the company lost business is not so important. It's, you know, unfortunate. But he or she can look back at the 2 years and say, well, yeah, we had a really nice time. My employees really had a great time. They loved each other. They had cooperation. They respected each other. We were honest. We had this tremendous honesty among each other. I feel really good about those 2 years. It's too bad it failed. But I can carry those memories with me the rest of my life about what a good environment we created. So it's two very different intentions create two very different kind of results in the inside. Now, it's a very hypothetical example, but I think intention is very, very powerful. Yes, Mira.
Trying on that story, it's parallel to what I've been going through. I've been doing a job search, and getting caught up in the rat race, and doing these companies with the hottest and the latest technology. And as it turns out, after interviewing with like 14 companies, the two companies that are interested in me are in the printing industry, which is where my background is. And what I'm finding is both companies, people are incredibly nice. And I go and I interview with them, there's just this incredible spirit. And the tangent to what you're saying is more, they almost have the time because it's not as fast paced and the values are more similar to where I am.
Mm-hmm.
But in these companies where it's, you know, like the latest and greatest, getting caught up in the rush and getting caught up in that momentum, it's like there's not as much time for that humanity aspect. So it's just interesting that you brought that up. I can see that.
Lily Tomlin said that the thing about the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat. But, you know, making time for something different to happen. What I find is that a lot of the things that I think people cherish in life, that I value a lot, isn't something that I can make happen. So, for example, I'm not very good at making myself happy. I can make myself feel pleasure or pleasant. I can make pleasantness happen or sensual pleasure or something. But to feel happy, I can create the conditions that will help make it happen. But it's more like I have to create the conditions and kind of open to the possibility of it, and maybe it'll happen. I can make pleasure, but I can't make happiness so easily. In theory I could get people's praise and get a lot very famous, but to get friendship from someone else or to get their appreciation of me, I can't make that happen. I have to allow for that to happen. I can get lots of knowledge, but wisdom, you can't make wisdom happen. You can't kind of read a book on wisdom and then carry around with you and say, I got a lot of it. It's wisdom is something kind of a lot, you know, kind of percolates up, you know, it's kind of mysterious where it comes from. Yes.
That kind of distinction is really interesting, because I think that there are also sort of similar two similar categories of intention that you can have. The ones
yes.
That you can sort of grasp with your brain, and the ones that come out of a certain element of self-discovery.
Uh-huh. Say a little bit more.
Well, it's sort of a recent thing that I'm finding with myself, that there is a pattern whereby if I go with intentions that I make with my head, it's sort of a little bit akin to maybe the types of intentions that the guy who wants to make a million by the age of 30 makes, even though that is not necessarily specifically my goal. But that I eventually find that I'm much less happy with the choices that I make in that mode than if I sort of wait for intentions to arise.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be able to put my finger on where they arise from, but so that's perhaps an interesting question.
Uh-huh.
But it pays off to wait, is the experience that I think.
Often it does. I'll tell you, this somewhat relates. When I went off to college, when I was 18, my father, who's a university professor, was going to give me some advice, you know, about college, what to do when you get to college. And he gave me, I think, what turned out to be very unusual advice. Maybe it wasn't usually not expected. And he said, when you get to college, go find yourself a park bench near the library and just sit there. And just look around and just kind of sit there and think and muse and kind of hang out until you find you're interested in learning about something. And then go to the library and look it up.
Did you?
I didn't do it that way, but that's the spirit of that idea. I kept with me. You know, the idea that the idea to kind of wait until something moves inside of me. Mm-hmm. One of the kind of indirect forms that advice took for me was after 2 years in college, I was basically happy in college and enjoying my various classes. But you have to, after 2 years, you have to really decide on a major. And there was nothing that I had a passion for, nothing that inner kind of great desire for wanting to do. And so I dropped out of college. You know, I said I won't go back until I find, you know, this passion or this great desire, this great, what feels really right for my heart or deep inside. I'm just going to go and do something else for a while and see what happens. And so it was kind of like the equivalent of sitting on the park bench. And though my father wasn't happy, he might be dropping out of college. But this allowing for something to happen is really crucial in a spiritual life, at least. Allowing for, yes?
Well, I'm just wondering if there isn't, I mean, can you address rectifying intention?
For example?
Well, often one will realize that the impulse intention is basically not fruitful, that it's harmful intention. Say, being in a hurry driving, or potentially harmful. And then one can rectify that and say, ah, this is a harmful intention. I intend to change it. And so rectification is a very important part, and that may be part a little bit of a head trip, but still a very valuable thing to rectify intention.
Oh yeah, I think so. But there might be another option, and that is, rather than rectify, pause for a little bit and allow some space to see, like the woman here, you know, what do you really want to do? How do you really want to drive? What is really your deeper intention? And then rather than rectifying because you know X is wrong, just simply follow Y, because Y feels more heartfelt.
I wouldn't say wrong. That was
or painful or harmful.
Unskillful.
Or unskillful, yeah. Thank you for good Buddhist language. Yes. He only listened to himself. Yes.
A couple of years ago, and maybe it was even a lot longer ago than that. It was before I came here. I decided to be more generous, sort of as an experiment. I don't know why I decided to do that, but I don't know. I read something in a book or something like that. And I started doing it, you know, in a small way at first. Like when I would go to somebody's house, I would bring them like a bouquet of flowers or, you know, a little gift or something like that. But I would do it very consistently, and I sort of widened it to other parts of my life because it seemed to be kind of it seemed to have delightful consequences, you know? I did notice that.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of widened it to different parts of my life. And I think when I started doing it, I was like sick and I was very kind of thinking about myself all the time, you know, and my problems and all that sort of stuff. And I noticed over a period of time that my life began to change for the better. And also, I began to get a little bit less, you know, sort of consumed by my own problems and stuff.
Beautiful.
And I noticed that was cooking something for the homeless people, how much I enjoyed it. I mean, I like wanted to empty my house out. I was really getting into it.
I had a friend who was had for a while some very severe psychological problems. She really couldn't do Buddhist meditation. Her mind was too unstable. She went to do various forms of therapy. During the time I knew her, what proved to be the most helpful for her was she went to her Buddhist teacher, who suggested that she practice generosity. And she had almost no money, so it wasn't a matter of giving money away. It was just to be generous with her time, her smiles, whatever way she could. And so she just practiced generosity, and it made a huge difference for her. It helped her much more than the particular, you know, therapy that she was doing at the time. Maybe I should be careful what I say. Those of you here on Monday. Yes.
It was a very good topic that you brought up last week, and so I proceeded on Friday to set up that my day was going to be about questioning my intention. So I see this young fellow every day, and he's the youth or the FedEx driver or whatever, and I always say, "Hey, dude, how you doing?" You know, I don't know his name, but I always say hello, and he always says hello back. And so he comes in with all these packages, and I'm standing at the reception area, and I said, "Would you like a donut?" And he just nods. You know, I don't particularly like those things, but I know a lot of folks do. So he says, "Are you kidding?" And I said, "No." And so I brought him to the kitchen, and he took a donut, and I said, "You can have two of them." There's a lot there. And so that felt really good. You know, I typically like to be as generous as I can. But the thing that I started at the beginning of this month, of December, was I grew up with a Catholic background, and Advent time is this time of the year. And I decided that my mother has a certain amount of suffering that I am not the cause of. I'm clear about that. But what I decided that I would do with her, because she is having such suffering and doesn't find a way out of that suffering, that whatever my interaction with her would be mindful, so that her experience with me would not be about suffering.
Beautiful.
And it's a struggle to see someone having such difficulty. But it turned it around for me, because I knew the only thing I could clean up is how I presented myself to her. And it's really helped a lot, you know, little things, a mass card that they say, a mass on New Year, Christmas Eve, that I sent her, that she really liked, and a nice card with a few dollars, and next week I'm going to send her a little flower bouquet. And you know, if that makes a difference for her, to find some cessation of suffering, then that's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I can't fix her disconnect.
So that's so there's a beautiful line by T.S. Eliot. It says, "Teach me to care and not to care." And I think the task is to learn both. How to care more, and how not to always take responsibility. So to offer, you know, the love and the care, and learn how to really care well. The task for Buddhists is to learn to care and not to care at the same time. Yeah.
In nursing, one of the things we learn, I don't know if this is a phrase that would help people, is compassionate detachment. And that,
compassionate detachment. Because you could connect earlier, what you said earlier, with what you said now, a little bit, in my mind at least, was I read a study once that maybe many of you have read of. It was either shopkeepers or librarians, where they were really kind of actors or something, and they were told some of the librarians or shopkeepers were told to just kind of have a normal exchange of money and goods and whatever, or the books or whatever. And for half of them, that was in the other group, that was a control group, and the other group was supposed to, when they exchanged the money, was to ever so subtly, so that the person wouldn't really notice, touch them. So it has some physical contact. And then they had people outside the library or the store or whatever, and said, you know, "We'd like to do a survey for you, what you thought of the store and the prices and all that, and you know, whatever." And so people would answer, and then they ended ask some question like, you know, and what do you think of the cashier? And friendly, unfriendly, or whatever. And the only difference was this matter of little contact, and they found that when there was a teeny bit of physical contact, they were perceived as being friendly. Mm-hmm. And if there wasn't, so it can be very, very subtle. The doing something positive for someone, it doesn't have to be such a big thing. Sometimes they might not even notice you're doing it for them, and it actually helps them.
Gil?
Yes.
Intention for me is, you know, right there with metta.
Yes.
Sometimes I felt there is something happening outside of myself. you know, if I intend for someone and then all of a sudden they call and we haven't been in contact for 6 months uh-huh. or something, but that a kind of touching, even though there's no outward.
I don't know. I don't have an idea. I just know that life is really mysterious, and the more attentive I am, the more amazingly mysterious things seem to be. But I don't know what's going on out there or here or anywhere. I think that the intention to offer loving kindness, it's my belief that it has tremendous power. And it ripples out from us into society, into the world, in very, very powerful ways that it might be very invisible. But the consequences can be great. So how it works, I don't know. What's going on, I don't know. But I believe in it, somehow. I don't know what I believe in. Just that. I don't know what's going on. This is maybe kind of a non sequitur, but sometimes the message people get from learning mindfulness meditation is that they're supposed to be observers, and it can be very helpful for some people to learn they have the ability to step back and just observe life, observe their mind, their thoughts, their feelings. And you don't have to get involved with them or get involved with your feelings or get involved with your thoughts or get involved with what's happening around you. You can just watch and be present. It can be very freeing to do that. However, to be an observer also keeps us a little bit removed. And I think that ultimately what we are and what we become more fully is really participants in reality. That nature, life, the world is not something out there that, you know, we watch and hold ourselves distance from. But really, it's a participatory world that we're in. And as the mindfulness gets stronger and more, we realize the mystery of that participation. And as we realize that we're participating in the world in a full way, then it makes also some sense to be more attentive to our intentions. Because the intentions are part of this whole ecology. That's not just simply the ecology of a self, but the ecology of everyone. And we're intimately connected. And it comes back, you know, it goes, you know, the Beatles song that said, you know, the love you get is equal to the love you give. Is that how it goes?
The love you make.
In the end, the love you take is equal to... So, you know, when you get a sense of the interconnectedness of all of us, the interconnectedness of life, and I think you feel that most fully when there's a sense of allowing and acceptance. If we're always in the doing mode, in the power mode, in the acquiring mode, it's very hard to make room and space for any sense of feeling of interconnectedness, and from which is born caring and love. And But when there's an allowing, a space that allows something different to happen, and we feel that we're participants in the world rather than just observers or victims or agents or whatever, I think that the idea of loving kindness and doing loving kindness, the idea of generosity, and the fact that it comes back, becomes a stronger, stronger sense. And one of the sentiments. That gets born from that, at least for me, is a tremendous feeling of gratitude. I think that with practice, sometimes it takes many years of practice, but hopefully with any spiritual practice, a person's sense of gratitude becomes stronger and stronger. And gratitude is one of those things you can't create. You can't make yourself feel grateful, can you? I don't think so. But you have to allow for the possibility.
Well, I think you have to be reminded of it. Like the other day you mentioned that.
Uh-huh.
I think it's very important that occasionally we get those reminders, because we all have a lot to be grateful about. So we can be so consumed in our own lives and problems and careers or whatever that we decide about. So those reminders are very important.
Yeah, but because I said it last Monday, I was reminded myself. And I found myself, it was very odd, maybe it's a little bit embarrassing to say this, but because it's maybe kind of almost silly, but it's true. I guess it was the next day I was driving, and I was looked at the asphalt on the road, and I was grateful for those people who put the asphalt down. You know, I'd all my life taken it for granted, these people who were putting the asphalt down, and you know, they had nothing to do with me. My life depends on them, the way we structured our society, and you know, I depend on them almost as much as I depend on you know, parts of nature that supports us. When I told this a number of times, but when my undergraduate degree, I went back to college, and. I kept going back to college. Now, no more. I can't go back. I can't. But so my undergraduate degree was in agriculture, and I took a lot of classes in agronomy, agriculture, and botany, and ecology was very important for me. I thought ecology was the closest science gets to religion. Because ecology teaches you that you're participating, how intimately your life is dependent and interconnected to everything else. And then at Stanford, I got a PhD in religious studies, which is a little bit different than agriculture. And however, of my whole college or university career, the most spiritual class that I ever took was not anything in the religious studies department at Stanford, but was my botany class, my introduction to botany. And we were taught about the cycles of nutrients and the cycles of how, you know, oxygen and carbon dioxide. And I would leave the botany class and I'd walk out into this great courtyard and I'd look at the trees and I'd be kind of stunned. I'd kind of come out kind of stunned in some kind of way, like I'd been on a retreat, and I'd just look at these trees in a completely new way. And I would look at them and I would kind of stand there and I'd wonder, where do I begin, where do I end, and where do the trees begin? And I would reflect that, you know, I can do without one of my kidneys, I can do without one of my lungs perhaps. There's a lot of things that I consider a very important, intimate part of myself that I could do without. But I can't do without the plants, the trees that make oxygen for us. It wouldn't be, if you took, you know, you got rid of all the plants in the world so I can keep my kidney, for example. That's not going to do me much good. I'd rather give up my kidney. And so something like that, those kind of reflections go through my mind. And I would just stand there in awe and amazement and wonder, where do I begin and where do I end? The sense of participatory world, that I'm really part of it all. In the same botany class, they taught us, back then, this is, you know, over 20 years ago, so it's old news now, but back then it was fairly new discovery in biology that inside of every cell and every living being, and each human being, there is a little organelle or something. I think it's called the mitochondria, which creates the energy, makes the energy that pumps out, you know, makes the cell work and do its thing. And the discovery was that these mitochondria are actually separate living organisms that in ancient times had been ingested into some bigger single-cell organism. There used to be just single-cell organisms floating around, right, in the Great Sea. And at some point, the bigger single-cell organism swallowed the smaller one, which is the mitochondria, and they formed a symbiotic partnership that worked really, really well. So well that they started making multi-celled organisms, and eventually they made human beings. So, you know, we think that we are we. You know, we're less like human being, right? One single thing, one single organism. But actually, each of our cells contains a different organism. It's independent of us in a sense. That's we're completely dependent on also. So who are we?
That part of you is all your mom.
Mother Candor, that comes from the mom?
Yes,
it's all maternal DNA.
Yeah, it has its own DNA.
So there.
And since it's in the egg cell, that's how they trace back.
But it's not hers either. It's just as if an organism.
Her mother.
Eventually. But it's just a different being that's kind of going along for the ride. So anyway, these kind of, they would teach us this kind of things in botany, and I was just like, wow, you know, who are we? Who am I?
Who are we?
Who are we? And I never left religious studies class at Stanford. They had this big courtyard there too, right? I would never go out to the courtyard by the chapel and go, wow.
Live.
Yeah. So part of what mindfulness practice does, both in the sitting practice and bringing mindfulness to daily life, is not so much insight or discovery into what life is exactly. It is, but one of the important functions is simply to allow for something new, allow for a new opportunity, new possibility that wouldn't occur if we were always directing ourselves and always directing what we're doing. It's kind of like, not literally so, but it's kind of like pausing for a moment. Like I paused in that store just a little while ago today. I paused at the end of the transaction and something different happened because we did that. To pause and allow for something to happen. It's a very good practice to do over the holidays. If those of you who might spend time with your family, the practice of pausing and waiting to allow for something to happen. You'll be surprised. I suspect that you'll find it all. Those of you who tend to get into trouble with your family, I hear there's a lot of people get in trouble. For a lot of people, holiday times like Christmas or Thanksgiving or times when people, Hanukkah, when people get together a lot, there's a lot of suffering that happens. Families who struggle and don't get along. And it's a lot of it. It's very painful to hear the stories. But if you're one of those families, use the mindfulness practice to see if you can allow for something different to happen that wouldn't have happened unless you kind of paused and made some space. Space where we don't react, but wait. And one of the things that gets born by that pause is not so much that you're waiting for something outside to happen, but maybe something outside will happen that's different. But maybe what will happen is by pausing, some deep, different intention inside of yourself will have a chance to surface. I know that if I watch my speech, the intention of why I speak, it's a very rich area of study. Very, very rich. It's one of the richest places to study intention. Why are you really saying what you're going to say? Many of the things that you so beautifully said at the beginning, I notice in me when I speak, and am I really wanting to impart information? Or do I want to show off my erudition? Or, do I want to make sure they see me in a certain way, so I'm going to make sure I'm going to tell them something about me. So not because it's kind of interesting information, but I want to make sure they know that's who I am. So I'm creating a sense of self, a self-image. So paying attention to intention. But if we pause and wait for a minute and allow for something different to happen, you might find that maybe what you want is not so much what you originally thought, but what you want is maybe something deeper, a heartfelt connection, or maybe a realization you don't need to create a sense of self out of the way you speak. You don't have to show off or show your erudition or whatever, but rather to allow for some different possibilities, some different intention to surface. Some of the more beautiful intentions, not that you have to have them, but the Buddhist word is beautiful, so it's a technical word, for example, the intention for loving kindness, for sympathetic joy, for compassion, for generosity. Beautiful intentions that resides in all of us. This thing about allowing, another part of it is that the Buddhist tradition teaches, and it's my belief, my understanding, that at the core of who we are is something is really beautiful. The core of who we are is something really shining and luminous and bright and sacred. And it's our fundamental goodness resides. It's very different than teachings, for example, of, you know, original sin or fundamental sin or something. The Buddhist tradition teaches more like the fundamental goodness of all of us. And as we allow, make space, and allow ourselves to be, and start leaving ourselves alone, slowly, slowly, what will begin to kind of shine forth will be that fundamental goodness. If we're always busy and running around and following, kind of, you know, caught up in all the different desires and wants that we might want, sometimes there's no space and room for that fundamental goodness to surface. So that seemed like a nice thing to maybe end, given that we're in the middle of these, middle of Hanukkah, 2 days or 1 day before Ramadan, and a few days before Christmas, and a couple of days, a few days before solstice. What else is happening?
Impeachment.
Oh, impeachment. impeachment. I wish the people doing the impeachment would also pause. And the bombing. Pause and look at their look at their intention. See if there's something deeper coming from their fundamental goodness. Anything else anybody wants to say?
I would motion the same thought regarding the bombing personally. And I know that everybody's gonna have a different opinion about that. I would motion that the people that are pressing the buttons and you know, playing the video games took a second to think about the people that were receiving those bombs. Mm-hmm.
I would second that motion. All in favor?
Duly noted.
So let's end with a little sitting.